Bones, pulverize. Please be seated.
Yes, Ms. Reese.
Thank you, Commissioner. Before the break, we were talking about validations, particularly one validation report, 192. In your email when you wrote to Justin Howes in March of 2018, you were talking to him about what you perceived the risks to be of a situation where there were some ongoing concerns that you had about the reliability or the accuracy of the validations of particular instruments or pieces of equipment in the lab. As I understand what you set out in the risks to Mr. Howes, which is at that 8 March email, which is Exhibit 4, Commissioner, you don't say that a risk, for example, is that reported profiles are unreliable. You say that the risks are that defence might ask for copies of validation reports. They might seek expert advice as a result of their concerns with validation, for example. There might be rejection of DNA evidence due to inappropriate validation or verification of equipment. You raise the concern, in which I understand would flow from that, that there might be the potential for rework of hundreds or even thousands of samples, that the lab might lose scientific respect in the community and by other DNA labs, that the lab might lose confidence and respect of the community because any successful defence challenge is obviously in public, in court. And you also talk about then having to contend with ongoing defence challenge and corresponding Section 95 reports as the lab's underlying science would be viewed as weak. Those were concerns that you raised with Mr. Howes 4 years ago.
That's correct.
Now, it's important to note that you, when you spoke to Mr. Howes, that you perceived each of those risks to be quite low risks.
Reasonably low, yeah.
Is that low because it was unlikely people would understand the issues with validations?
By about 2017, defence challenges on validations were very rare. Back at before 2010, they were much more common. So the risk of being challenged and having a defence expert come along who A, thought to look, B, understood enough stats to see that there were issues was quite low. But if you did have someone, it would lead to a chain of events that, you know, not dissimilar to what we find ourselves in now, whereby, yeah, our validations could all be called out and challenged. I've honestly kind of lived in fear for the several years now that I would be asked on stand if I was confident that our quality and validation processes were good, because I would have had to have said on the stand that I did not, and that would have been very problematic back at the lab if I had done that. It's just kind of fortunate that no one has asked that question until now.
Why have you told the Commission about these concerns?
Because it's, for me, it's the last-ditch effort to have someone listen. I've tried to alert internally. We've had departmental inquiries come through, and I've tried to talk to them about it. I've fed back through departmental feedback that we get every year, these problems, that these need to be looked at. Never gotten a response. No one's ever listened.
You say departmental feedback.
Every year we get a form that we go through to rate how the department, the section is going, you know.
At the Working for Queensland survey?
Yeah, exactly. Right. And, you know, I've mentioned that there are issues, scientific issues there. I've mentioned to the Livingston inquiry there were scientific issues, to the Workplace Edge inquiry that there were scientific issues. But, you know, no one's ever really taken it seriously. So I came forward because I take it seriously.
And you approached the commission because of those concerns. I'll turn to a question which harks back to something you told us at the commencement of your evidence, which is that you sought out a postgraduate qualification in experimental design and data science.
Yes, it was originally, it was just to get some qualifications. I originally enrolled in a Master's of Experimental Design and Applied Statistics, I think it was. But after doing half the subjects, I decided for a number of reasons to, I'd done all the core statistical subjects that I wanted to do, and I decided to not progress to the Master's and just take the postgraduate certificate at that point, which was a postgraduate certificate in data science. But the original Master's was experimental design.
And you told the hearing earlier that you did this because you saw that it was a need for that.
That's correct.
In the lab. And you saw that this was an area of interest for you as well, wasn't it?
It is, yeah.
And you approached, or in 2014, in your performance and development plan, which I think now is called a CSP, but was called
yes.
PDP then,
yeah.
You requested to undertake training in statistics in order to refresh those skills that you'd had as passing an undergraduate degree and then in your honours degree
yes.
and your early work life, but
yes.
hadn't used in your role as a reporting scientist.
I hadn't used for a long time, yes.
You wanted to learn about the new techniques for statistical analysis which had arisen in the time. And you've said in your statement to the commission that you were not actively supported to do so other than being allowed to use some professional development leave to take exams.
That's correct.
Can you tell the commission what support you did seek or consider seeking?
I looked at getting financial support for it. And I spoke to Justin Howes about it, and he seemed supportive of that and told me to refer me on to SSDU, which is our training unit. I went and spoke to them and kind of got the impression that it was very, very low probability because it wasn't considered an essential qualification. And they said I could put the paperwork in, but the paperwork, having looked at it, I just thought, no, I'll just pay for this myself, and then I'm not subject to the department telling me what I can do and can't do and when I have to do it. So I paid for that myself, and that was fine. But I kind of expected that there might be a bit more support. There was a time when I wanted to photocopy some notes using departmental resources, but I was denied that.
When you were told that it wasn't considered essential, your role as a reporting scientist doesn't actually include statistical design or analysis, does it?
No, it's not.
That experimental design.
It's not essential for me to do my day-to-day job, but I would argue that it's essential that probably someone in the section has it.
And who, do you recall who told you that it wasn't considered essential?
I believe it was Pete Clawson from SSDU.
And that's, SSDU is the Scientific Services Development,
yes.
Development Unit.
Yes.
And that sits across all of the work units, including
yes.
mortuary and forensic chemistry. All right. you're the only person in the lab, to your knowledge, with higher level statistics qualifications.
That's my understanding.
And you've given evidence today that on at least two occasions you were consulted, actively consulted by your colleagues about statistical issues. But is that commonplace for you?
No, and it's not usually prior to a project's commencing. It's usually those situations where it has arisen. It's been someone's been asked to review something and they've come to me and gone, what do you think of this? It's always after the fact, which is a bit too late then.
And you say in your statement that you've heard from some staff that they'd been told specifically not to seek advice from you.
That is what I've been led to believe, yes.
You give an example of a particular project where your colleague Emma Cornt asked for your assistance in for part of the verifier stutter analysis.
Yes.
And this was ultimately allowed because as it was understood, there was no one else capable of running the analysis required.
Yes.
Can you tell the Commission a little bit about what happened in the aftermath of your involvement in that project?
We wrote a report. The people who'd done that particular analysis, we wrote a report of our findings, sent it back in, and then we received an email basically that stated that, didn't state outright, but it kind of gave me the impression that it was not well received, that my name had been on the paper and that other people who were on the project but didn't contribute to that particular analysis were not listed. That was the gist of it as I read it.
You note in your statement that to you, your perception of that experience or that incident is that it's a clear example of professional exclusion.
I believe so.
You feel professionally excluded in your workplace.
Absolutely.
Say at paragraph 124 of your statement that the success of raising issues depends on who raises the issue. Do you mean scientific issues?
Yes.
And can you expand on that?
I think if you have a view that is contrary to what the decision-making group has, the burden of proof is much, much greater than if you have a view that is aligned with their view. And it's just my perception that, you know, if people like Kylie or Emma raise an issue, they get a lot more pushback than other people do.
What about yourself?
Well, I've never successfully been put onto any of these projects. No one's ever come to ask me about them. So clearly my feedback has had limited success. So I would have to say that I also fit into that category.
There was an example in your statement that you've had some success raising issues with Paula Brizzotto.
Yes.
But in general, management don't enlist you for any of this experimental design.
And that project would only have been improved because I found it by whatever means I came to it and then went and analysed it and said, hey, I think there's a problem. It was never a case of we've done this, what do you think of it or anything like that. So if I hadn't looked, it would still be doing what it was originally.
So it was happenstance, not design.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Spoken about that there should be a separate project team that's independent from the management team. Why is that important?
I think because the science should stand on its own merits. Now, obviously, there are going to be financial and other considerations going into what science has done, but I think because you're in management does not make you an experimental scientist. Having a science degree doesn't make you an experimental scientist. It's a separate skill, and I think going forward that the decision-making group has to be separated from the science, and then science is presented. Decision-making group can make the decisions based on that science, but I don't think that they should be running the projects because, in my opinion, you have the potential for inherent bias in that sort of situation.
Bias that might be based on concerns outside of the application of scientific principle.
Well, that and, you know, the tendency towards finding results that support your desired outcome.
Which is similar to the concern you raise about going straight to AMP rather than microcomming.
Yeah.
You say that your perception of the lab culture is that it's misogynistic.
It's just my perception over the years talking to female staff that they seem to have a lot of problems getting access to flexible work arrangements, particularly if they have children. You know, to my mind, as long as they put in their hours per day, doesn't really matter if they go home a bit early, if they start a bit early. to be flexible so they can take children to school or pick children up from school or go to medical appointments for the children or whatever. But it's just my perception over the years that they often have problems getting approval for long-term arrangements for those sort of things.
And a lot of your colleagues are women, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
You say at paragraph 131 that it's your belief that management have highly prioritised turnaround times, QPS requirements and cost saving over results quality. What do you base that on?
On the validations that have been done, the removal of or the automatic microcon process, the fact that we sort of, my perception is that we acquire a piece of machinery and then post hoc validate it rather than getting two alternative means of performing a particular function and then assessing them both side by side and then choosing the one that's best. We get something and then I'm not aware of any situation in which a machine has been obtained and then has gone, oh, that's not suitable, we'll send that back and get something else.
You talk specifically about turnaround times, though. What impact do turnaround times have on what you say, which is this emphasis on turnaround times over result quality?
Well, there are times like, for example, with the DIFP stuff where people aren't reworking things that they might normally because we have to get it out for court or we have to get it out quickly. For some stuff, there's plenty of time, but a lot of stuff we get, there's not a lot of time. And so we don't rework as optimally as we might if we had more time, weren't constrained as much in terms of when we had to get results back by.
Sorry, I didn't hear that last.
If we weren't as constrained as what we often are in how quickly we have to get results back.
Where does that pressure come from? Who talks to you about turnaround times?
It has been mentioned many times in the past in meetings, team meetings. We don't tend to have team meetings anymore. Not sure why, but particularly in the period of Paul Savant's management, there was a lot of issue around turnaround times and that we weren't getting results out fast enough. And I think since then, I can't think of any specific examples recently where it's been, there's been pressure internally for that, but I think it's just become one of those cultural issues that there's just you need to get it out faster. It's always pressure to get results out quickly rather than necessarily pushing them as far as you might like.
Commissioner, that's the evidence in chief.
Thank you. Mr. Hunter?
Perry, can I just ask you about scientific concepts of accuracy and precision? They're two separate concepts, correct?
That's correct.
Accuracy is, when you're talking about a measurement, is how close the measurement is to the true value.
That's correct.
But precision is about repeatability of independent tests.
It's sort of how closely you are to that, how closely your results are to each other. So you can be, let's say you're shooting at a target. So if you're hitting in the bullseye, you're accurate and precise. If you're missing the bullseye, you're inaccurate, but you can be clustered, all your rounds can be clustered in a nice ball over here. You're still precise, but inaccurate.
Right. So high precision does not necessarily mean accuracy.
Not necessarily.
And the goal when undertaking validation is to ascertain that the results you're going to get from using a particular piece of equipment or a particular testing methodology are results that are both accurate and precise.
That's what you're aiming for.
Yeah. And the data that was identified in Project 192 was neither accurate nor precise. Correct?
My opinion.
Can I go to the 6th of June this year when you learnt about the abandonment of the DIFP workflow and the amplification of what I'll call low quant samples without micro concentration. Now, you were notified about that by email, is that right?
I believe so, yes.
And was it immediately apparent to you that what was being proposed made no scientific sense?
Yes, yeah.
Because all that would occur if you amplified these low quant samples without first micro-concentrating them is a very high likelihood of a useless set of data.
If you got anything at all, yeah.
And obviously you were aware of what the procedure was with respect to low quant samples prior to the start of 2018 when DIFP came in.
Yes.
What was proposed on the 6th of June this year bore no relationship to what had been was being done.
Well, it skipped the micro concentration step.
And am I right in thinking that you can't think of any proper scientific reason as to why someone would propose processing those low quant samples without first micro-concentrating them?
No.
If, though, you wanted to convey perhaps to someone who wasn't across the science that, look, see, there's no point in testing these low quant samples because you don't get any results, that would be one way of doing it, wouldn't it?
Potentially, yes.
One other matter, I'm not sure that you're asked about this, but in terms of the allocation of a particular case file to one reporting scientist, that's something that does happen from time to time.
It does.
What about though when results come in for interpretation in the reporting section? If, say, you were allocated a particular case file, would it necessarily be the case that the results as they came in would all come to you?
Not necessarily. It would depend on if it was assigned prior to samples coming in. So operations and high priority cases are often assigned beforehand. So in that case, generally the reporting scientist would be across all the case management in that sample. But sometimes if a case becomes larger and is going to be for a statement, it will be assigned to someone, but some of the case management will have already been done, so it'll be a mixture of people.
Is that a desirable state of affairs?
Not for larger cases. I think for volume crime or low-level property crime, having large lists where people just pick and choose is fine. But I think for sexual assaults and serious person offences, it's probably better to assign cases just for consistency.
It's important, isn't it, that a scientist who might be considering reworking some samples knows about all of the results in the particular
case? It's generally best, yes.
Because, for example, if you were going to micro-concentrate a sample that had been previously reported as DIFP, the extent to which you would concentrate it might be informed by what the other results had already provided.
Yes.
Thank you. That's my question.
Thank you. Mr. Rice? Oh, Mr. Dean? Who's going first?
I'll make you go first. Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Parry, I appear for Ms. Pizzotto. In your statement of paragraph 99, if I can be put up on the screen, yes. See in the first sentence you speak about, you complained about the validation concerning the project 192 to Ms. Brizotto, and you've said there that she took some notes and told you that it would be fixed, but that you were not consulted about the matter again.
Okay.
So that's a conversation that, plainly enough, on the face of it, must have occurred after you'd become aware of the content of the original report from Project 192.
Yes.
if the witness could be shown Ms. Keller's statement, Exhibit AK24, was up on the screen earlier. We need a number if needed.
0459-0001.
Thank you, Commissioner. And if we can go to the second page of that document, please. You'll see there the sign-off on that document by the first four, at least, of the management people. And we've got dates ranging there between the 6th of April and the 10th of April.
Yes.
And then over the page, other signatures also in that date range.
Yes.
So that appears to be when the report was finalised. Do you have a recollection that it was soon after the finalisation of that report that you became aware of?
I honestly can't remember. I believe it might have been Ms. Keller who brought it to my attention, but I can't remember how long after this it was.
All right. In any case, once you became aware of it and had an opportunity to see what it provided for, you had some concerns about it and you identified them to Ms. Brazotta.
That's correct.
Commissioner?
I believe I may have identified them to Justin Howes, who referred me on to Paula Brazotta.
I see. Okay. Commissioner, my instructing solicitors only about 20 minutes or so ago forwarded some documents by email to the Commission. I have some hard copies, but only three. So I can, if they're not available electronically, I can proceed with the hard copies, providing you with a copy.
Right, let's see if anyone knows about this.
It's possible it's been sent to the operator, Commissioner, but I don't know that that has happened.
Can you assist the operator in yes. What it is we're looking for?
The first document is a document headed Project Proposal Number 192 Supplemental, and it bears the date of April 2018.
It's not on the. It will have been emailed to you, if anything, I think, Mr. Operator.
Sorry, I can't find anything in my email. Ms. Hedge, why don't you go outside and see if you can make a phone call while Mr. Dean?
I can. I suggest you just use the hard copy.
But we'll keep doing that.
Yes.
For the moment, yes. So if Mr. Associate, if you go and get those documents, and give one to Mr. Perry and one to me, please. Thank you. Oh, now this one I think is.
Commissioner, it's not the same document.
Oh, it's not the same one.
It's
all
not
right.
The same document as RP9.
It's not right. No. All right.
But yes, that may be explored, but it's not the
Excuse
exact
me a moment.
Document.
I see.
It's a project proposal rather.
Yes,
than
yes, I understand. Go ahead, Mr. Dean. We'll carry on and see what happens.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Parry, I'll give you as much time as you need to look at the content of the document, though seeing it now may have brought back memory for you. But you'll see the title on the front cover of the document, and it indicates that it's a document being authored in April of 2018. And if you go to the second page, you'll see document details as the heading, and it indicates there that the contact officer is you.
Yes.
And that the version history shows this document as being version one with the date of 27 April 2018.
Yes.
And that the document or the document description is document created and the column heads changed by Rhys Parry.
Yes.
So that indicates, does it not, that you're the author of the document?
It does. I honestly had completely forgotten about this document and I apologise. Apologise if I have misled the court in that regard, but I had seriously forgotten I wrote that.
Mr. Parry, remembering the details of all of these sorts of things must be very difficult. I'm not here to offer any criticism of you for that, but rather really to take up the sequence of events to see if your memory can be assisted in that regard. It's the case, is it not, that you must have identified the concerns that you had with the original report of Project 192 at some time between about the 10th of April, when the last of those management signatures went on it, and the 27th of April, when you authored this document.
That seems reasonable, yes.
And sometime in that period, you spoke to Ms. Brizzotto about those concerns.
Yes.
And indeed, I then wanted to show you another document removed from the stapled bundle.
And there are the sequence, just so I'm following it, Mr. Dean, the sequence is that the Project Report 192 was circulated, having been approved in early April 2018. And then in late April 2018, Mr. Parry has written a project proposal for 192 supplemental.
Yes.
And what you're putting is that that must have happened as a result of his conversation with Ms. Brizzotto.
Yes.
Yes, thank you.
If I can show you a further document, Mr. Parry, and again, the same number of copies being all that's available, Mr. Associate. Harry, this document self-evidently is an email from you to Paula Brizzotto, no other recipients, on the 30th of April 2018 at 9:07 a.m. And it says, here is the updated project proposal. If you have any questions, please feel free to ask. And the whilst it describes that as an updated project proposal, the document I can suggest to you that was attached to it is the version of the project proposal that you have with you at the moment.
That's probably the case, yes.
Now, just to make sure that this is understood correctly, when I showed you the second page of that project proposal 192, it said that that was version one. Version 1.0?
Yes.
Is it possible that there had in fact been an earlier version that you had then made some amendment to but didn't update the version number in the box on page, on the second page of that document?
Look, given that I had forgotten that I'd even written this document, that is possible.
Yes, all right. In any case, what is now coming back to you in terms of your recollection is that you, having identified the concerns you had and spoken to Ms. Brizzotto, you came to prepare and perhaps then amend a project proposal to investigate the very concerns that you had about the original paper.
Yes.
And we know, do we not, that in April 2020, a report that corresponded to this project proposal of yours was finally produced?
That the final supplemental?
The supplemental report.
Yes.
The one that's attached to your statement as Exhibit 9.
Yes.
All right. So appreciating what I said to you before about the lack of criticism about not remembering the details of these things, when you revisit paragraph 99, you would say that you complained about the validation verbally to Ms. Brazotto. You explained the issues and that what flowed from that was that you were invited or permitted to provide to her a project proposal for the investigation of those concerns.
Yes, I retract that third sentence. Sorry, I was not consulted. Clearly I was.
Right.
And
the sequence must have been that you complained about the validation in the way that you described, and you then were invited to and you prepared a supplementary series of experiments that you put forward in Project Proposal 192 Supplemental.
Yes.
And sent that to Ms. Brazotto. So that's the stage we've reached in the story so far.
Yes.
Go on, Mr. Dean.
Yes, thank you. And then what seemed to follow from there was that that proposal was acted upon and a report was prepared.
It appears so, yes.
You weren't one of the authors of the final report in the end?
No.
No, thank you. But you became aware of its publication?
Yes.
And you attended those two documents?
Yes, I'll make the email from Mr. Parry to Ms. Brazotto, dated 30 April 2018 at 9:07 a.m., will be Exhibit 72. And the project proposal number 192, bracket supplemental, close brackets, dated April 2018, will be Exhibit 73.
Thank you, Commissioner. Those are my questions.
Thank you. Who's next?
I will, Commissioner. I will.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Rice, yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt. If it assists anyone further at the bar table, those documents are now with the operator and can be placed on the screen.
All right. I don't think it's necessary, I guess.
I don't know my learned friend's intention.
Anyway, if anybody needs it, we can do that. Yeah, I'll give you those. You can give them to, just hang on for me. Yes, Mr. Rice.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask you about one matter in your statement, Mr. Parry. It's at paragraphs 112 and 113 on page 20. Just take a moment and refresh your memory of those.
Yes.
Is it right that, by way of background to that, in the first half of 2021, there was a project being undertaken relating to Verify?
Yes, that's my understanding. Okay. I was not involved in the early parts of it, so not certain when it began.
No. Okay. And I think you relate in paragraph 112 that Dr. Scott was the project leader for the project that was underway.
That's my understanding.
Right. And in addition to her, is it right that there were a number of reporting scientists assigned to that project as the so-called Verifiler team?
That's my understanding.
Is it right that those scientists were, that is, the reporters, associated with the Verifiler team, that they were Ms. Johnson, Ms. Quant, and Ms. James?
At least. I don't know if there were more, but those people were on it, yes.
And when you say in paragraph 112 that you understand or believe that Emma requested your assistance for part of the analysis associated with that, the relevance of Emma is that she was one of the Verifiler team of reporting scientists.
That's
correct. Correct?
That's correct.
Right. Now, in due course, the document that you refer to as Exhibit RP10 was prepared, co-authored, I think, by yourself, Ms. Caunt, Ms. James and Ms. Adamson, as we see in paragraph 113.
Yes.
Perhaps we'll have a look at that. Perhaps if Mr. Yes, that's it. It's RP10. And we can see in the heading of that that the four authors. Correct?
Yes.
Well, if we go to page 37 of that same exhibit, Mr. Operator, we come to the email that you exhibit as RP11. You recognise that email?
Yes.
And you'll see it's an email from Dr. Scott to four persons, being the four authors of the report that we just looked at the first page of, correct? All right. You'll see as the email opens that Dr. Scott thanked you four authors for your extensive assistance and the incredible value of the document that had been prepared, correct?
Yes.
Expressed her appreciation for your effort and the hours put into it, correct?
Yes.
Okay. In the third paragraph, she makes mention that we have a verifier team, being the three that I mentioned to you before, and she mentions workshops that had been conducted, again, to assist with the progress of this particular project.
That's what it says, but I have no knowledge of that.
Well, I was going to suggest to you that there were two workshops conducted to which a range of scientists were invited for the purpose of sharing ideas in a collaborative way to advance that project.
Possibly. I may have even attended them.
That's what I was going to suggest to you, that you were invited as part of your acceptance into participation in this project. You were invited to participate in one of the two workshops.
Possibly, yeah.
Okay. And if we go to the second paragraph, this is the one that you make mention specifically in your statement. Dr. Scott said, "I feel a little uncomfortable about how we're proceeding with authorship on this one."
Yes.
Okay. Now, the authorship she's referring to is the document, which is RP10, which, as we saw, had four authors, two of whom were part of the verifier team and two were not, correct?
Yes, I guess so. Yes.
Right. And the upshot of that is perhaps in the final paragraph, bar one, commencing with the words, "Given that we still have a long way to go." You see, Dr. Scott was looking for some clarity on the authorship, which would become more complex as the project proceeded if it wasn't sorted. That's what she says, in effect.
I guess you can interpret it that way, yes.
Well, in relation to that authorship, you'll see in the next sentence she expressed her preference that the verifier reporting, that all verifier reporting and interpretation reports be co-authored by the three persons who were the reporting scientists associated with this particular project. Correct?
Correct.
But she goes on to say that those three should be co-authors, quote, as a minimum, unquote. That is to say, not to exclude other authors. Do you agree?
Well, that's yes, yes.
Okay. And the reason is so that it was clear that the verifier reporting team, being the three reporting scientists named here, would be overtly associated with support for the document by virtue of their co-authorship. That's the point she's making, is it not?
I guess so.
Right. And in terms of incorporating other staff, you see from the final sentence that she's not dismissive of that, but would appreciate a discussion to regularise the authorship so that, at a minimum, the verifiable reporting scientists were all included for the reasons she gave, correct?
Correct.
Well, arising from all of that, your original agreement to participate in this project, your participation, as I put it to you, in the collaborative workshop, and her leaving it open, Dr. Scott leaving it open to additional authorship beyond the three reporting scientists, that this is not, as you say, a clear example of your exclusion from professional exercise.
I took it at the time to mean that it was irregular that my name was on it and it wasn't listed as per the verifier team. Now, I can't recall why Sharon's name wasn't put on it originally, but essentially, from my memory, Sharon didn't contribute to that particular aspect of it, so it was just written as the four authors who contributed. I took this to mean that that was inappropriate, that my name shouldn't have been on it because I wasn't an official verifier team member. I'm not sure why we would need explicit discussion as to an author being on a paper that they had co-authored. So I took it to mean that my name shouldn't have been on there.
Mr. Perry, if we look at the third last paragraph beginning, however, this document does not contain all verifier reporting and interpretation sub-project staff. Maybe I'll start again. I'm just not familiar with this notion of authorship. What does it signify if your name is on the cover of a report, such as Project Report 192, which is Exhibit 24 to Ms. Keller's statement, has the names of four scientists on the title page? What is that supposed to tell anyone? What does that mean? What's the sign in your laboratory if a name appears there?
That you've contributed to the project in some way, or that you've had oversight of it, is my understanding. I'm not sure if there are hard and fast rules about it. So normally the first person will be the major writer. Second or third author will be people who have contributed largely to the research, and the last two names will be project supervisor, and the last name will be Kathy Allen, who, as the chief scientist, oversees all projects, so is on all projects.
I see. All right. So in this case, RP10, the report relating to stutter, Ms. Kaunt, Ms. James, Ms. Adamson, and your names are there.
Yes.
In the first place, do we take it that the four of you worked up this report, did the work for the purposes of this report or not?
Well, this was just a sub-report to report back on a small aspect of the overall project, so we didn't think it needed to...
No. Yes, I understand. Whatever it was, but the your names were there because the four of you worked up the... did the work that led to this report being written.
Yes.
Right?
That's correct.
So what was Ms. Bizzotto's concern about the document containing all verifier reporting and interpretation sub-project staff? Was it that she wanted all staff within the relevant area to be credited on the cover of a report like the one we're discussing? Is that you understood it?
Yeah, that other people should have been on it.
All right. Now, just so I understand it again, in the second last sentence of her email, of Ms. Scott's email, she says, "My personal preference would be that all verifier reporting and interpretation reports were co-authored by Sharon, Emma, and Cassie as a minimum, so that it's clear that you support the document as written." So that suggests to me that Ms. Johnson, for example, might not have written the document or done the work involved in the document, but her name ought to be on it to signify that she's read it and approved it, that she takes responsibility for it. Is that how you
understand? That's a possible explanation, yes.
And then in the last sentence, perhaps this is the key to my understanding of it, other staff, if we incorporate other staff, then Ms. Scott would appreciate a discussion. Who are the other staff that is non-verifier reporting and interpretation sub-project staff? Are you a part of that staff? Were you a part of that staff?
I was not officially on the project. I was just brought in for this one particular analysis.
Oh, to do some particular work on it to do with statistics?
Yes.
So are you the other staff?
I assume so.
Is there anybody else who is...
There may have been in other aspects of the project. I wasn't part of any other.
I see. All right. Thank you, Mr. Dean. Mr. Rice, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
With reference to the words other staff in the final line, can I suggest that that must be a reference to yourself and Ms. Adamson being two of the four authors of this document who were not part of the Verifiler reporting team?
Potentially, yes.
Right. Now, your participation by way of assistance in this project had already been agreed, had it not, as per paragraph 112 of your statement?
Yes.
So what I want to just suggest to you is that having regard to your agreed inclusion in this project, that insofar as you've taken a professional slight about this email, that none is really justified. What do you say to that?
Well, that's the way I took it at the time. Could I have misinterpreted? It's possible.
Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Hickey?
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Parry, I appear for Cathy Allen and for Justin Howes. Could I ask you questions, please, just to clarify some of the things that you've said in your statement? The first is, could we go, please, to paragraph 9 of your statement? This is where you give some evidence about a conversation you had with Mr. Howes in July of 2017.
Yes.
In which he asked you to review those calculations in the spreadsheet that you were taken to very early in your evidence to that. And what you say there is that he stated he was data mining the results of historical Microcon processes but provided no other detail. Can I suggest some things to you to see whether it might prompt your memory about things that were discussed at that meeting? Do you recall that he mentioned that he was re-looking at the data for auto microcons based on anecdotal feedback from staff on their feeling that not much was being obtained?
Oh, that's possible.
You'd accept that he may well have said that to you?
He may. I don't recall. I don't recall. It certainly wasn't presented to me as a project with these defined goals and outlines.
Right.
So he possibly did.
And he asked if you could look at the data to check and if there were any other ways to look at it.
No, I don't recall being asked to look at it in different ways. It was just to check the document.
All right. Now, were you aware that you had been listed as a technical reviewer on the project plan for Project 184?
I was not aware of that until fairly recently.
But you're aware of that now?
Yes.
Okay. Then can we go, please, to paragraph 53 of the statement? Now, here you're giving some evidence about an issue that had been identified in the forensic register, and you describe in paragraph 53 that in 2019 further information had come in for a case which has been redacted, which you weren't aware of until someone told you sometime later.
Yes.
Were you aware that the situation that you've mentioned in paragraph 53 was the reason why an enhancement was raised in the forensic register to help with the awareness of items received post-statement?
I'm aware that that exists now. I'm not sure if it's been implemented, but that was, I believe that was one of the reasons, that particular instance was one of the reasons why it had been raised.
Yes. And I think you said just now that you're not aware whether it's been implemented. Even in fact, has been implemented. Would you agree with me that that's an appropriate outcome to a situation where you had identified something that should be improved?
Yes, sure.
Thank you. Now, in paragraph 109 of your statement, if we can scroll on to that, please, you give some evidence about staff being routinely, you say, denied the ability to obtain new skills. Secondment or temporary release to work elsewhere is not an option, you say. And in particular, you give some examples, and one of those is Ms. Julie Connell. Now, I think you say in your statement that you've been working at Forensic Services since 2006, so I presume you're aware of the comings and going of Ms. Connell over time?
Yes.
And is it that to which you refer in saying that her personal circumstances couldn't be accommodated?
My understanding was she wanted to get secondment to the AFP in Canberra and wasn't allowed, so she quit her job here, went to work for them for 2-3 years, I can't remember, right, and came back and acquired, reapplied for a position at FSS and acquired that position and worked there for some time before then leaving to work for the police.
All right. Can I just put some facts to you to see whether it accords with your understanding of Ms. Connell's situation or not? The first thing is that Ms. Connell requested a 12-month secondment to take up a position at the Australian Federal Police.
That's my understanding.
And that secondment was in fact approved by Greg Shaw?
That was not my understanding.
All right. She then applied, having gone on that secondment, for an additional 12-month secondment. Were you aware of that?
No.
And that she advised, in fact, that she was in a permanent position at the AFP when she sought that additional 12-month secondment. Were you aware of that?
No.
Were you aware that advice was sought from Workforce Support and HR and that Mr. Shaw was advised that it wasn't in FSS's best interests to approve the second request for secondment?
No.
And that the decision that Mr. Shaw ultimately made not to approve that second, the extension of the secondment, was based on that advice?
And I'm sorry, Mr. Shaw got advice from whom?
From HR and Workforce Support. I presume that's something within the department.
Yes, thanks.
You weren't aware of that?
No.
All right. And then I presume you're aware that in 2011, Ms. Connell came back to FSS?
That would seem probably about right, yes.
About right.
Yeah.
Were you aware, by way of background to that, that she had contacted Ms. Allen about a position in forensic DNA analysis?
No.
And that all was available at that time was a temporary position, not a permanent position?
No.
But in any event, she was offered that position and was welcomed back. I presume you're aware that she was welcomed back.
It was my understanding that she'd applied for a job, but I could be wrong.
And then because it was only a temporary position that was available to her at FSS, she took up a permanent position with Queensland Police.
Eventually, yes.
All right. So given that alternative set of facts that I've suggested to you, would you agree with me that you're using, if you assume that all of that is true, would you agree with me that by contrast to what you've suggested in paragraph 109, at least in the case of Ms. Connell, she was given an opportunity to seek a secondment and to work elsewhere for a period?
If the facts as you lay them out are the case, then yes, I would concede that my understanding of the situation was incorrect.
All right. Now, my second last question is this. If we could just scroll on, please, to paragraph 126. Here, give some evidence about some, what you say is limited success he'd had with raising issues with Ms. Brizzotto, but management never come and ask how an experiment could be designed or how best to analyse the results. As such, many of our validations are invalid. You've given some evidence about that earlier today.
Yes.
Are you aware that experimental design is provided to all management team members so that management team members can seek the input from staff members generally?
There's a project proposal which outlines the experimental design, which they assess and decide whether it should move forward or not.
Were you aware that it was open to you to ask your line manager to be actively involved in the review of experimental design from time to time?
No, because we don't know that the projects are taking place, generally speaking.
But generally, have you communicated to your, and sorry, before I ask that question, your current line manager is Sharon Johnston, is that right?
That's correct.
How long has she been your line manager?
since 2018 or 19.
And prior to that?
For a short period, it was Matt Hunt.
And prior to that?
Amanda Reeves.
All right, thank you. Did Amanda Reeves, for instance, ever tell you that it was open to you to express a general interest to be involved in experimental design?
She may have, but I had expressed general interest in having a role in these projects.
And you expressed that to your line managers?
I'd expressed it to a number of people.
Can I ask my question again? You'd expressed it to your line managers?
I believe so. Maybe not Sharon, certainly prior to that.
All right, thank you. Now, the final issue is you were asked some questions about some evidence you give in your statement, and I'm afraid I can't tell you the immediate paragraph reference, but it's probably of no particular moment. You suggested that the culture at the lab is misogynistic.
That's just my perception.
I understand that. And you, as an example of that, as I understand your evidence, the fact that there is some inflexibility around a desire by staff to have flexible working arrangements.
That's one of the principal reasons, yes.
And you mentioned people who have childcare commitments and things like that. Is it the case that you're aware of any situation where a man has been granted flexible work arrangements that were refused to a woman in similar or identical circumstances?
Around childcare?
Yes.
Not I'm aware of.
All right. And I'm not intending to be tricky or smug about this. I'm just trying to understand the four walls, if you like, of the suggestion of misogyny. Is there anything other than that apparent inflexibility around work arrangements which you point to as evidence of the misogynist nature of the culture of the lab?
I don't know that he was saying it was misogynist. I think he was saying that the climate is inflexible, the culture is inflexible, so that, for example, scientists who seek alteration in hours for childcare purposes are not granted that. It's not that that females are treated differently from males, it's just that bracket of employees are not given the latitude that they want.
Well,
that's how I was understanding it, but I might have missed something.
Can I explain to the commissioner why I'm asking the question?
Yes, certainly.
The evidence that's given in paragraph 129 is that Mr. Reese says, "I feel that despite the gender balance of the management team..."
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. Yes,
the laboratory culture is quite misogynistic.
No, you're quite right. Carry on.
You're right, Commissioner, that he goes on to describe that flexibility. No,
carry on. I had not appreciated that word was there.
Thank you, Commissioner. So you understand, Mr. Reese, what I'm trying to explore with you is whether there is something other than what you say in the second sentence of paragraph 129 when you say the lab's culture is quite misogynistic.
I could see that might be wording that's a bit more forceful than I had intended. I would still argue that the inflexibility towards female staff and their childcare commitments is inherently problematic. To me, it's an example of somewhat misogynistic sort of view of HR rules.
I think the point you make in the second sentence with respect is clear enough, and you can understand why in the current climate a word such as misogynistic carries with it particularly important connotations. And so it's important that we understand, and that the Commissioner understands with real precision, what you intend by that term misogynistic. And you've just said it might be given greater emphasis than you intended. Is it something more than what you describe in the second?
I would probably be using it more in its original, not so much in its current cultural context. But I do think it's I use it in the sense of there are some rulings that seem to be unfair towards the female staff in FSS.
But can I, again, and I don't intend to be painful about this, is that because it's the nature of the requests which are being made, or is it because, in your view, they are females who are making the requests?
it just seems to be a lot around, it just seems to be a lot, well, it's going to be female staff making the request because they're the mothers who have the children who, you know, and I'm probably not the best person to ask about this. This is just my perception of how it is. Ask some of the female staff. You know, I'm sure they're more aware of how it is because they live it every day. If they say there's no, that I'm off track, then I'll recant that and retract it. But that's all I can tell you.
Thank you. That's helpful. Those are the questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Anybody else? No?
Commissioner, I do have some re-examination.
Yes, go ahead.
I might. Thank you. Mr. Parry, just on that point, how is it that you come to know about any concerns about flexible work arrangements?
Because I hear the female staff talking about it frequently.
And what do you observe? What impact does that have on them, that issue of flexibility in the workplace?
Many of them seem very frustrated about their ability to obtain it or the hoops they have to jump through in order to get it.
And is flexibility of work arrangements sought for other reasons other than childcare and child caring issues?
Yes, they are.
For example, ill health or disability?
Yes.
Perhaps caring for other family members?
Yes.
Do you observe the same issues arising with flexibility requested for those types of arrangements?
My impression is that it is easier to get it for those reasons than it is for childcare. But that, again, it's just my perception. You'd be better off asking the people who actually are involved.
Mr. Parry, you've been asked some questions about this proposal, which you'd forgotten about. And if I could ask that it be put up, I understand it's been sent through to the operator, the proposal itself rather than the email. Project proposal 192 supplemental. You still got that document in front of you?
The hard copy.
Not the email, the project itself. While we're waiting for it to come up, I'll just ask you to look at page 2.
Yes.
And the way that it's been presented in evidence is that it was attached to an email to Paula Brizzotto as a Word document. You'd agree with that?
Yes.
This proposal, to your knowledge, ever accepted by the management committee?
I don't know.
And you... There's a space there for signatures. If this document had been accepted by the management committee or approved, would you expect that there would be signatures on the version that was approved?
You would expect, yes.
And that follows the same pattern with the final report, doesn't it? That there's a page where the ownership is reflected.
Yes.
For the proposal, it's the approval, and for the report, it's the authorship.
Yes.
And the are you aware, I think I asked you, you're not aware that this actual proposal was accepted by the management committee?
Not that I'm aware.
And is the methodology the same as between your proposal and the work that was carried out and reported on 2 years later?
There are similarities without going through it fully. I couldn't say, but it's possible that they followed the methodology based on the results they obtained. My bigger concern with the supplemental bone project is the results themselves, the disparity between the repeatability and the reproducibility, the disparity between the expected organic extraction quants and the obtained experimental extraction, organic extraction results, not so much with the design of the supplemental.
Your concern about the methodology in the supplementary report was that it was vague.
Yes.
The way that it was expressed in the report. But you say that your concern was these variability of results, and this is at the bottom of paragraph 100, that the you had the – is it fair to say that the variability of results and the analysis of those results are what you're concerned about in relation to that supplementary project?
Yes, it's the results themselves, not so much the design, because at face value they had corrected the problem with the low sample number, the n equals one issue, and they had corrected the repeatability and reproducibility part. It's just that as written, the supplemental for Project 192, the methodology is quite vague. It doesn't actually refer to this document.
So it doesn't refer to the project proposal?
It doesn't refer to the comparison of organic phenylchloride, et cetera, that I can see.
Would you like to consider the document after lunch and then briefly return to just answer a final question on that?
I'd be interested, Mr. Parry, in knowing whether and to what extent the proposal that you put forward does or does not conform to the project as it was carried out.
Sure.
Thank you, Commissioner.
2:15, Ms. Rees, is
yes,
that right? We'll adjourn till 2:15.
All right.